Hey everybody, time for another Shop Talk show. This is number 280. Dave and I are going to do a little sharing of some secret things, personal things. It's going to be pretty fun. Then we're going to get some questions after that. We're going to talk about the, you know, React world and testing within it. We're going to talk about like gathering client requirements. We're going to talk about frameworks and whether they're for beginners or are they more for advanced developers or both, or what's the dichotomy there. Mr. Dave, please kick things off.
Hey there, Shopping Maniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. It's the fancy Shop Talk Show. From the 1930s, it's a Shop Talk Show. I'm wiggling my arms. Chris, what's happening?
Hello! We had this idea, actually, before the... Because lately we've been like, let's do... You know, it's fun to just, like, talk about, like, some tech topic that's been on our mind that week. We've been having lots of fun doing that. So we're like, what to do? We didn't have, like, a very obvious one. There hasn't been any, like, big hot drama, like, in the last few days, I feel like. Other than, I guess, the Node... Although, by the time people listen to this, that'll feel like a month old at this point. But, like... No drama, but that bores me a little bit. Not like it's important stuff, so I'm not like shooing it aside, but like, ugh, I don't feel like talking about it.
Why does it keep coming up? Ugh. So what was the idea for today?
Well, the idea was like, okay, since we don't have one big obvious idea, let's talk about lots of little ideas in the form of draft ideas, you know, because I think both of us like literally keep draft blog posts, but keep a list of ideas of other potential blog posts or just miniature ideas that could turn into something one day, but certainly are not fully fleshed out ideas yet. So it's share your draft folder day here at...
Okay, share your drafts folder. You have your drafts folder open?
Yeah, I have a couple of different ones, actually, but I do have an...
Oh, whoa. You got, like, the command center?
Yeah, totally. I have, like, personal notes, then I have the Trello board, which is the official one, and then I have the actual literal drafts in my CMS.
Okay. What do you want to go first? Do you want me... I was thinking maybe...
We'll go back and forth? Or what?
Okay, or, like... Let's share three, and then you pick one to hear more about.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
If we have to do another round, we'll do it.
Yeah, we can do it. Let's see. Do you want me to? I'll choose three, huh? Sure. Or you choose. You choose.
All right, I'll do one first. Here's the miniest.
The meat and taters.
This isn't even meat. This is like one pea in a
shred.
This is the tiniest little pea in the world, but it distracted me the other day. You know, there's input type date.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. What's something that you can imagine that you'd want to do with input type date? Like maybe you'd want to like limit it to a week range or something like that. You can do that. Yeah. There's lots of stuff you can do. There's all kinds of stuff you can do. In fact, you can put a placeholder in there, you know. But here's something that I think is just painfully obvious that you'd want to do with input type date is to have it be pre-filled with today. And right now, you can't do that. There's no HTML way to say, just have it be right now, you know? Because I'm like...
Value today.
No, because I want to like save something to the database that's time-based and like I want it to be today, but it doesn't have to be today. It could be last week. So I want you to be able to change it. But by default, it's right now, you know? So like, what would you do? Like, I think it just makes sense to, I mean, you can do it with JavaScript. And I found like a little tiny one liner that can kind of do it. And there's like, you make a new date object in JavaScript. And then there's some function that I've never even heard of before called toISOString. And then that makes this big crazy string that just so happens that a substring of that between 0 and 10 is the same format that you need to put the value in for it to work in browsers. So you can kind of get a string pretty easily in which to then hit with JavaScript to pre-fill it today. Not great. Like, there should be a better way, I would think.
Yeah. I mean,
so it's just a little miniature blog post.
I mean, you could do that, but then you got to check to see if like the value exists or whatever. Yeah, that's funny. That's funny that there's not like a just today. You know, also with like input type equals year, is that one? No, that's not one.
No.
But like number, you know how like you're doing like credit card form and you're like this year plus 10 or whatever, and you just have to like manually write those? That's silly too.
Now, right? That I think back on it, I think I might be, if I was designing the form UX wise, I might have it like not even ask, like, do you want it to be right now? Or you do need to change it. And if you need to change it, then you like click a radio button or a checkbox or something. And then it opens a date box in which that you can pick the date that you're aiming for. And that way, if they don't click that, it can just use the server time, which is hopefully correct.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't, whatever. That way they don't have to use the date input at all if they don't want to, you know.
Yeah. Huh, yeah. It'd be nice if there's like pre-populated values.
Yeah, I mean, just last week we were complaining about how HTML isn't stepping up and doing useful stuff.
It's not progressing. let's see. Chris, I have a post for you.
Okay.
Are you ready? Hold on. hold on. Do you know the two best books about web design, Chris?
Two best books about web design.
I mean,
this is tough.
Putting your book, Practical SVG,
aside,
and my book, Money Driven Management, also available on A Book Apart. What are the two best books on web design? You know,
I can't guess. I think this is gonna be a trick question.
It's Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud.
Oh, that's a good one. I have that one.
And the sequel to that, which I can't remember, but I'm looking at the side of it. Hold on.
It's like More Understanding Comics or something, isn't it?
Yeah, there is a more. Reinventing Comics. It's so Understanding Comics is about comics as a visual medium. And we saw Scott McCloud speak at Conf in Orlando. Chris and Ari put it on.
Yeah, I had it at the tip of my tongue, and now you can't remember, so I can't remember.
In Control. In Control Conf. And so it was awesome, but you realize, like, comics are this medium where you can only use a limited number of words, and it's a very visual medium, and you're trying to convey it like a very succinct message, you know? And the parallels, I feel like, between web and comics is almost more than, like print and web, you know. It's like comics make a lot more sense in terms of how you're telling a story with a limited number of speech bubbles, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, it was a very inspiring book, and then he also takes like visual, you know, you go from like super high fidelity to like super low fidelity, you know, like an etching of a face versus like a circle with like two eyeballs in a smiley face, you know?
It's a real page turner, like, of a book, because everything in it is, yeah, like that. It's super compellingly explained in how you feel the way you do about comics, and challenges the notion that you like or dislike them, and I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's a justification that this is a real, like, comics are a real thing and not just child's toys, you know, basically. And so it's wonderful. It's written in the 90s, but I feel like it just applies to the web so much, like the talk of fidelity and like iconography and skeuomorphism, and then there's this whole thing like how an artist perceives, you know, when they're young they start at the surface, but when they're older they kind of start in the core of the idea and build outward. It's just phenomenal. I think you need to read it. And then Reinventing Comics is the sequel. And not to get too like hot drama here, because I don't think it is, but talks about the like diversity in comics and basically kind of chastises comics for being drawn for like 13-year-old boys, you know, like super testosterone driven, and he's just like, there's a whole world of people who read comics, you know. You go to Japan, it's all like everyone reads comics, like it's 100% adoption rate, you know, in Japan, and you know, it's anyway, I just, so there's a whole world of people who want to read comics. You just have to write the stories for them, you know, and the way that works is comics become more diverse and stuff like that. And then, you know, that book was written, I guess, probably 2000-ish, and you're seeing it now. You're seeing like Marvel kind of like say like, hey, yeah, we should kind of introduce a lot more diversity into our universe because it's a little, you know, it's a little bit white dudes in underpants. So anyway, it's a really good book. And I think it like the parallels to even like tech and web are amazing. So those are my two best books on web design. Chris, share your draft. Hashtag share your drafts.
That must have been in your drafts forever because we saw him forever ago at that conference.
Yeah. Can I see when this was originally written? I don't know. I have another post about one of his thing. It's about cognitive overload. You're familiar with this term? Sure.
No, go ahead.
So in that talk, Scott McCloud, he's shows this panel from Tintin, and it's from the Calculus Affair, and it's this crowd of large people, you know, and like there's a guy with like a film camera like looking over a wall, like there's so much going on that you stop, you like, and he shows this thing and he just says cognitive overload, and you're just like, what? I like the universe stopped for me. You know how that happens, like when somebody just literally explodes your mind. And he was using too much information to slow me down. He said, there's so much information, you, the user of this comic, have to pause while reading it. And so you can control tempo, you know, by presenting too much information. And I thought that was amazing because just, you know, in websites, we deal with information density, you know, and, you know, do you, you know, if you're writing like a news website, do you throw up another column like a Trello board and just keep like building it like packing more information, or do you set a max width and just like present a readable amount of information? You know, there's so many parallels again to comics that it just blew my mind. So anyway,
that's funny because it seems like something that would have to be skillfully wielded, because like it worked in that context because maybe it was like low to medium density for a long time and you're feeling good, and then you get one panel of over density and it literally caused you to pause because you were you're already invested or at some degree. But if everything was that dense, like would it work still? Maybe not, you know.
And it's like when everything animates on a page, you know, it's like, yeah, nothing, I find myself animates, getting nauseous, you know? Yeah. Nothing animates. So like you can use tempo and timing and just to just overload the user at a point where you want them to be overloaded and stuff. Hey, it's just kind of cool. And then I think about, you know, like we have CSS Grid and layouts like this. Jen Simmons is a big advocate for non-boring layouts. I totally agree, but I'm just also like, what beats a tube of content, you know, like in when you want to interrupt, you really got to be like, you know, I want to interrupt the natural flow of reading a website and do something unique for a very strong purpose. And it's just, you know, it's just interesting to me how that all works. So anyway, you think of Dribbble or even CodePen, but like Dribbble, you know, you like expand the window and you get more and more and more and more and more dribble shots, you know, to where all of a sudden at a certain point you don't see dribble shots, you know, you just see little weird squares, you know, just because there's so many. You know, like that's stuff we got to be kind of concerned about, just overloading the user, you know. So
I like it. So we have from you, we have comics or the two best books about web design, and they're Scott McCloud's books and another Scott McCloud concept, cognitive overload.
Yep, those are my two.
Cool, nice.
Hashtag
share. Unrelated, not a draft of mine, but a friend of mine handed me a book, a comic book the other day that I had never heard of, but it was apparently a famous, popular comic book that I've been highly enjoying reading. I'm about two-thirds of the way through it, called Kingdom Come. You ever read that one?
Ooh, no, I haven't.
It's like a Superman-based one, but like every superhero ever, and it's like in this like dark future where, I don't know, I won't spoil too much of it, but it's worth checking out. I haven't been like totally raptured by a, that's not a good word, but really into a comic book in a while, and it's been doing it for me.
Yeah, yeah, like my friend Kevin Sharon gave me some comics from her birthday the other year, and it was good. Like, it's just nice when somebody finds something they think you like and they give it, you know, and you're like, you just dive in and you're like, this is great.
I have another like pea-sized one, so I'll do I'll be responsible for the pea-sized ones, and you be responsible for the big ideas. This is that, so we were talking about at CodePen recently. We got spend some time making sure everybody's editors were all good to go. You know that we're all using RuboCop and we're all using Prettier and we're all using ESLint situation. Like we have Git stuff in the sidebar. Let's just make sure everybody's like happy and healthy in their editor, which was good. And so sometimes naming or like rules come up. Like we got to make sure that our ESLint stuff is checked in properly to the repo and that everybody's editor is finding that file and using the rules. So if we change a rule, everybody gets it immediately and that kind of stuff. So some things come up, like most of the stuff has already been done. We were just kind of fine tuning a few things and whatever, and make sure we had Prettier in there because Prettier is just the best. Anyway, which format stuff as you save it, you know, you use it, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's great. You just save and it looks like a professional coded.
I think there's one thing that Prettier doesn't do that was annoying us though, is we decided on this idea, or they had me convinced of this. This is a tiny little pea of an idea that if when you're declaring a function in JavaScript, that you should say the name of the function space left parenthesis, right parenthesis, right? Instead of saying name of it and then just with no spaces opening and closing parenthesis. On purpose, because A, it doesn't matter, and B, when you call it later, it does matter, I think. Or at least you're having a separation between. So if I have a function Dave, when I'm defining it, it's Dave space left parenthesis right place. Later, when I call Dave, I'm going to say Dave no space left parenthesis right parenthesis. So that way, there's a straight up differentiation of when I'm defining it versus when I'm calling it. So I can use find and project and much easier find the definition of it. And maybe that doesn't matter to everybody because you have your editor set up so fancily that anywhere you're calling it, you can just hover over it and it will reveal exactly in the code base where it is and show you a preview or some fancy stuff like that. But not all of us have fancy setups yet, you know? So I just like the idea that you can find in project for the definition of a function just because as a standard, we've declared it differently. We have that space before the first parenthesis.
And then
the blog post would be not just that, but what other things do you do in your code on purpose with the main reason that you do it is for find in project.
Ooh, see, that would be an interesting, like, I mean, like to do
with sure.
A colon. That's
a good one.
And I use plugins to kind of manage that. Yeah, that's a good question.
I don't know them all, but I just, that's the kind of thing where I have a couple like those and I could put it on Twitter and get like some ideas pretty quick and then make a blog post. And then the comments of the blog post are good too. It's one of those like almost like a free blog post idea because it kind of writes itself in a way.
Yeah, because you could kind of like, you'd be able to, find in project hacks. That's interesting. That's good. But you're saying Prettier doesn't let you do that?
I think that was one of the things. I mean, maybe we fixed it, or maybe it's a bug that we logged or somebody else logged or something. Because, yeah, I think it collapses it and you can't, you know. And then you're like, oh, what? Boo.
But I guess you could just type function the thing, but that's maybe less fun. That's interesting. Finding project hacks, you know. I've been doing this thing, so I'll make like a, you know, I'm working on a shopping cart for a client. I have a cart CSS, and I've renamed it, and that's kind of for the layout of the cart, you know, because it's got like a very special sidebar, you know, like the checkout button.
Are you using a table?
No, I'm using Grid.
Oh, interesting.
And it's beautiful. I'm using like float fallbacks because it has to go way back, and then I'm using a Flexbox too because Flexbox is so nice, you know, like it's got this thing. But I think I may rip out the Flexbox just because it's maybe overkill, but it looks great in like IE 11, you know. That's kind of who Flexbox caters to now, since everyone kind of else has Grid. But Grid is pretty wonderful for that, because you're just like, this is a, you know, it's a 1FR space 300, you know.
You know what's the thing I like about Grid that doesn't, that I don't know if it's just me being weird or what the deal is, but I like how it sometimes it feels faster. Like if you rewrite something that you've looked at a million times in Grid and then kind of refresh the page, I think Grid is actually literally faster at like it feels more solid, like the thing that you've declared is a, or Flexbox, some of my old Flexbox layouts feel a little bit like, oh, they got a render, but then like some content comes in and it's got to kind of refigure itself out a little bit. And the Grid never suffers from that. And I feel like there really is like a feelable perf improvement sometimes.
Oh, yeah. A Grid makes me feel like we've never actually had, I've probably said it before, we've never actually had layout engines in the web. We've only had alignment engines. We've only been able to like throw things around on a page. We've never had a true layout system.
A lot of people have said that people have been saying that for years and years and years, and I never really bought it. Like I was like, whatever, float, I know it maybe wasn't like originally intended for layout or whatever, but it's clearly usable for layout. We're not doing something that it absolutely wasn't intended to do. I mean, you can set boxes next to each other with it. That's how it was designed. That's layout, and I'm using it for layout. It's not a hack. That was previous me. And now I like look at Grid and I think of like all of the pain of float, and I'm like, yeah, it kind of was a hack actually. Not only did you have to clear floats, but it was super fragile and stuff would fall down and be weird. There was no kind of fractions situation that you could use with it, so it was very, anytime you added or removed something, you'd really have to be careful with. There's no alignment, there's no equal heights, there's no like, there's a, I have a laundry list of crap that's that really does, when you add it all up, you're like, okay, it was a hack.
Yeah, I mean, you had to use overflow hidden or clear fix. You know, you have to introduce more code to fix the side effects of other code. That's a huge code smell. So I guess I don't know where I was going. I was going with Grid in a cart. Yeah. Grid is cool. Grid for laying out this cart is awesome. But I have the cart list, you know, the list of items. And then you have cart items, like items inside that list, or cart list items, you know. And I really like, I'm like, it's back to the naming things. Like, how do you name things? I just get stuffed, man. I'm like, I have like 5 lines of CSS for the cart list, but I don't want to like make a whole CSS partial for the cart list, you know. So I'm just going to stuff it in the cart item. But I think I'm doing future me a terrible disservice, but you know, but I don't know. I think I've actually, I need to like abstract a list component, you know, like a generic list formatter, mm-hmm. like spacing and borders and all that, because that's all the kind of cart list is really doing. So anyway, maybe some position relativing, but yeah, anyway, I don't know. Your comment about like hacks or whatever is, I've started this convention where I put the list and then the children in the child's partial. Does that make sense? Like the cart item partial also contains a cart list component. Like, anyway, parent component. Anyway, it's messed up, Chris. I'm not proud of it. And explaining it here is embarrassing.
No. So is that your third one?
No, that was just me commenting about my bad code. Let's see. I got a third one. What would you like to learn about? I am not going to share my three-part series, What I Don't Like About Capitalism, because it's a very long. It turned into like 10,000 words, Chris. It was very, whoops. So here's a neat one that you might not be aware of. Using Babel with Jekyll Assets. Hey, have you done this yet? No?
I don't even quite get it. Because I don't use a ton of Jekyll, you know.
Okay. If you use Jekyll, it's pretty rad. So you have Jekyll. Jekyll has like a SAS folder it compiles out to. But if you want kind of like a more Rails asset pipeline kind of thing, you know, I'm like digest fingerprints, like it'll add like an MD5 hash in the URL.
Yeah.
You kind of need for production and then, or auto prefixer, you know, you want to kind of run it through auto prefixer or something like that. You're kind of getting into like wanting to use Rails asset pipeline, and Jekyll assets is that it basically has is a, it, it's that engine put inside Jekyll, which is kind of Franken beast, but it works pretty well. So you don't have link tags anymore.
You use some special Jekyll, like insert link tag here thing.
It's like bracket CSS, you know, then some file name. And it's great. But if you want to do JavaScript, it can actually munge all your JavaScript together, like using require style statements. And that's great too. But if you're using ES6 and you want Babel to transpile it, you kind of have to jump through some hoops. And this guy I work with, Julian Jones, we figured it out. There's some documentation on it. You have to like add the ES6 sprockets gem or something, sprockets ES6 gem to your gem file. And then the one trick that they don't really like isn't super clear is you have to name your files like main.js.es6 to like trigger the Babel compilation transpilation. So anyway, it's neat. If you're interested, I'll probably post this before this show goes out, just because it's a pretty quick and dirty one.
Okay.
Yeah. Was that good? Do you want more theoretical?
No, that was pretty good.
Okay.
I feel like I have to go bigger. I have to pick one of my bigger options now for drafts.
Go big.
So one of the I have on my mind that I'll probably need to partner with somebody with, because I think you need to make a web form, right? And I'm a little bit like you, and then I kind of try to go down to the metal as much when I can and stuff. Like, it's just a form. I'll just code it myself, you know? I'll just type input type equals text, and I need a label, and I need a for attribute that matches the ID, and let's wrap that in a div just so that they break between the next one, and it gives me some styling options, and I need a form tag around the whole thing. And I hand coded a lot. I guess that's kind of fine, but I'm started to be like, this is such a pain in the butt. I always do this. Like, maybe I should like have my own little repo of like how I do forms generally, and just so like there's some copy and pastable markup I can just grab, because I end up coding forms the same way so often that whatever. So maybe I'll make like some tab triggers that output it in that way. So when I'm coding a form, it just like I can knock it out pretty quickly. But anyway, I got to thinking about that, and then I'm like, okay, I want to have validation for my forms. So there's all that like HTML5 validation stuff that I kind of want on hand. Like, I know how to make one required, but there's a couple other like go-to validation things that I reach for regularly. And then there's like, it turns out, you know, lately as I've been, you know, we published we had Chris F on, you know, recently, and he did that series for CSS Tricks on form validation. And basically the vibe around the web lately is that sure, HTML5 has like HTML level form validation, but it's not very good. And if you want to do better, like some JavaScript intervention is a good idea, and that you can get really far with this and have a pretty dang nice UX with like custom error messages and all that nicety and like just better UX, reaching for the JavaScript form validation methods. And then if you polyfill those just a little bit, you can actually get pretty deep browser support too. And the whole thing turns out to be like a couple hundred lines of code for like a pretty generic form validation like just situation, and with the polyfills and everything. So it's like, it's now, okay, great. Like, so I was thinking we should probably put together like a repo that's all of this stuff together. It's a really nicely semantic form with every possible form element in it. It's made to be semantic and accessible just by nature. And it has some CSS into it that's just like basic form styling stuff that you do all the time. Like, make my inputs equally wide and just stop being weird. And maybe even put the style, like some of the basic styling stuff in there that does all the overrides that you kind of often want to do. So like, and put all this form validation stuff in it, because this library is super generic and works on like any form. So the idea would be to just do some dang work and put together a repo that's like, if you're making a form, just start with this. It's all this stuff. Yeah.
You could even break that down into different types of form. Like a checkout form. I'm working on a checkout. A credit card form. I remember your HTML Ipsum repo, which is pretty sweet. Which is just basically like boilerplate HTML that I can like plop into a page as I'm building it out and then modify it. I was looking for that for like a credit card form. You know, it's like, I don't want to manually type all these selects for like the months and the years, you know, like this, that stinks. Like, so can somebody just spit this out? You know, is there like a snippet I can grab? And I couldn't find one on the whole web, you know, like an email capture form or like a, you know, there's, you know, and everyone's kind of different, but it's all kind of the same, isn't it, Chris? Like a comment form is usually like name, email, comment,
post. You could do that too. Like, you could drop some samples in there too into the repo, you know, because why not, you know, of just really ready to grab ones. It's just, the idea is that you can always find a repo that's got form styling, like here's how you, you know, rip down the styling and put up nicer styling for it, and here's one that, you know, is, you know, form examples of different forms, and here's one that deals with form validation, but they're never just all together.
No. You need like boiler form.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's a good name.
Because you have the input type equals checkbox, and then you have a label. But what if that label is like 50 miles long and it does the wrap thing? You need to think about that. And everyone I know has had to like, oh yeah, I have to recode that because it wraps on mobile or something. That's something you got to be concerned about.
Right. So it's tricky, because where do you walk the line here? Like, do you take into account every possible scenario like that? Or is it a little more lightweight? And how much theming do you actually do? Or do you intentionally make this a themable form boilerplate, which uses a bunch of custom properties and stuff? Or do you do it with SAS or whatever? So there's a million things you'd have to do. So I guess I would error on a lightweight, like no build process, just like here's just very lightweight CSS, JavaScript, HTML.
Yeah, no, I could definitely use that. It does, you know, and everyone does it a little different way. You know, like, what do you wrap your inputs in? You know, because I think everyone kind of tends to do that, you know, and it's like, well, I'd use div class input, but on this other side, I use div class field, you know?
Or maybe just a div at all, or maybe I used a definition list, or maybe it's a P because I want to watch the world burn, you know? And maybe this one I
put... I hate life.
And this one I put the inputs inside the label, which I think is a pretty good pattern in general, but...
Yeah, the like explicit or implicit labeling, which has accessibility ramifications, you know. So,
So that's what I don't want to do, is take on the world with it. I just want to combine a couple of things that make it go to and useful to me, you know.
Well, and I think that's like the boilerplate-y kind of aspect of it, just for forms, because that's something HTML5 boilerplate never really tackled, you know, was like forms. So. Yeah, that's a good idea, Chris.
We'll see if I actually do it. Probably not, but maybe I can find somebody to help with it.
Yeah, I could sling some CSS at it, some or some HTML.
Yeah, maybe we'll just make the repo and set out the goals for it and then accept PRs.
Yeah, we accept PRs and good attitudes, so.
Today's episode is brought to you by Full Story. Operating a site without Full Story is like running a brick and mortar shop with the lights off. You place one tiny snippet on your site, and it takes about 10 minutes, and that unlocks powerful customer experience, data capture tools, pixel perfect session playback, conversion funnels, and more. With all this data, Full Story can intelligently bubble up frustrated users and customers, sticking points in your site flow, script errors, and everything else your team needs to improve the site. All in an intuitive interface that lets everyone help build a better online experience. Pricing starts at $0. That's free. Don't you want the Full Story? You can use the link in the show notes or head over to fullstory.com/shoptalk to get a free month of Full Story Pro. No credit card or commitment required. Check it out.
Hey, Chris, it's like half hour into the show. Maybe we should get into some
Let's do Q&A's. Q&A's.
All right, here we go. We got a question from Chris Brett. Two first names. I like it. I've started using React.js for a new role and have been tasked with writing tests. Writing tests for these components using the Jest testing framework. Perhaps you folks have some experience with this or other JS testing frameworks suitable for testing with React that may be worth sharing. Also, often the different types of tests can be confusing to a new tester. Chris, are y'all testing your Reacts?
Yeah, big time. One of the nicer parts about it really is that the parts of our code base that aren't React are tested, but not nearly comprehensively enough, and it's a little more scattershot, whereas I think from the beginning, the very first React code we ever wrote at CodePen, it was all tested, you know, from day one. And there's like the Jest thing. Jest is like the Facebook, you know, like the official testing of React framework thing, which I think we use. I don't know, you know, like, admittedly, I don't write a ton of this, but the people who write most of the React do. But then there's just, like, the idea of prop types and stuff. There's, like, some mini testing that when you're writing React kind of, like, makes sure that you're doing a good job as you're writing it. But it feels much more invincible. I really like it. And just, like, the concept of Redux and stuff, which we're also using. It's like feels like once you've gone through as much ceremony as you have to go through to change all the state and let it propagate down, it's way less fragile. Like just the nature of the code is much it's not spaghetti-y. It's not, you know, like the type of bugs that happen to us in jQuery, do whatever you want land, are much less. I have an open bug right now where like if you heart a pen in a collection, so we made some weird change where visually the heart changes to a red heart on the pen, but it also triggers the animation of the heart on the collection. It doesn't actually heart it in the database. It's just a like weird like event propagation bug thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, ugh, because it's not a React page. It's just some, I'm just going to have to debug where that event bubbled up to and why it's triggering the thing and why it's like, you know, bound an event that got bound too broadly or who knows what it is. That those problems just naturally don't happen in React land.
Because it's the same component responding to some key updating.
Yeah, I mean, we don't even use components in the jQuery land. It's just a wild west of DOM flying action, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, we do use Jest and test, and that's the way to go. And you should do it too.
Yeah, I don't know enough about this. This is way too long on my list of shame, but I think it's like the next phase of where I'm getting at building out this pattern library. The thing I probably said this 100 times on this show, but the thing about testing is every test is like, okay, function add A plus B, you know, and return A plus B, or function add A comma B, return A plus B.
And then you have to expect it.
Yeah, and then a surge or whatever, you know, a plus or 1, 3 or add 1, 3 to be 3 or whatever. And then they're like, cool, now you know testing. And I'm just like, no, I don't. I don't. I'm not like the leap from like here to like how I like my component like fetches some URL, gets a certain response.
Well, and makes now you're automatically an async land, and we know that's weird and hard.
Yeah, so I'm just like, I can test the out of at addition, and to be honest, Chris, I don't think that's I hate that example because I'm just like the browser doesn't already test this, or like the JS engine doesn't already test the adding works. All right, I'll do it. But that's just a straw man. But it just the like leap from like here you wrote a test for addition to like you have 100% test coverage on your app is just not. My brain doesn't make that leap very easily. So anyway, it's my just list of shame. So I really need to step it up. But, you know, I don't know.
It's another institutional level thing. Like if a bug comes in and it was a bug in the JavaScript, then you get to push a test. But the very next thing that you're required to do as an employee of this company is to write the test that makes that thing not fail, or you know, that watches to make sure that that doesn't happen again. I mean, I'm just
and yeah. you've built that into your process.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that we are that strict about it, because I would say for most part people just like tests and they like that we have the coverage and mm-hmm. and write a lot of them. The way that they're structured is they live in the same folder as the other thing does. So if you have some component called paging or whatever, right next to that in a folder called __tests__ is a file that's named the same thing, only dash test. So there's paging and there's paging dash test, and they're right there, and they you know, they describe tests and they do stuff, you know, and these mm-hmm. tests are much more complicated. There's no checking if a function returns 3 when you add 1 and 2 for sure. But it's more like, here, let me set up this like array of characters, and then I want to make sure that here's another string that I expect those characters to be stripped out of. Now pass that to our stripping function and make sure that those characters were stripped out of that thing. Okay, cool. Now mm-hmm. if anybody messes with that stripping function, this test is going to fail, and we'll know that, you know, which is cool.
Yeah. Nah, I definitely see the value. The value's there. I just don't. It's just getting there and being in an environment that supports it. You know, that's the other part too.
Yeah, it's true, because it really should be integrated into your deployment and your pushing, and like it really does need to become a first class citizen there. I get it, because it's much more satisfying, especially as just my history as a front end developer. It's much more satisfying to just write the code, get it right, and then that the satisfying part of that wasn't like when the test passes. The satisfying is seeing it work in the browser and be like, nice, got it, nailed it, yeah, time to take a break. You know, not like now that I got it, let me write a boring test for it, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think my problems day to day, this is, I'm diverting the conversation, my problems day to day are not like oh, I need to test addition or a test stripping, you know. I feel like that's a very simple function, you know. People are going to flame me, but you know, just like that, the logic is not maybe my problem. I'm very logic light. My problem is I integrated it, deployed it, and then it doesn't work on Edge 14 because Edge doesn't have promises, you know, and I was using promises and I forgot to include the polyfill. You know what I mean? Like the testing machine would not detect that. So I need like a browser simulator machine to test this. And I think that's where I'm blanking on the name. There are frameworks to test that. Web driver, is that what it's called? Test driver, web driver. But which I think spins up Selenium VMs and stuff. But anyway, those are my problems, is like, oh, surprise, it's broken in like iOS 8 because iOS 8 is a random.
Yeah. I think it was before the show, but we briefly mentioned cross-browser testing, which has not sponsoring the show, but has sponsored other things I've done in the past. Anyway, I just think it's pretty sweet and use it regularly. I think of them first and foremost as it's a little website I can go to and spin up a copy of a browser that I don't have or a device I don't have and then live click around it, you know? Cool. That's a good feature. Mm-hmm. You can also do like the slightly older school thing, but still useful of like, show me screenshots of like 30 browsers, you know? That's cool too. Yeah. But another thing that they do is run your tests like this against, all X browsers, which is cool. So it's not just like spin up my test and spin up headless Chrome or Phantom or whatever and run these tests on that, or just run them at the command line or whatever you're doing. It's like, no, run these tests in Selenium on iOS 8 and Edge 15 and blah, blah, blah. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's nice, but you know what, how long does that take? Is it, I guess the payback is worth it. I don't know.
Like, it's also tests, what are you working on exactly? Like, is that your role? Is that what you're hired to do? Do you have, are you working on an app in which that it's your only job? And if it breaks, you're out of a job. I mean, we're just in a slightly different position as developers on CodePen of what's up. I mean, this is all we do. So it needs to be tested. You know, it's not. We weren't hired. There's no in and out here. This is our baby. It has to be clean.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Anyway, you know what I mean.
Hey. Yeah. Yeah. No. I know. That's CodePen is a product. It is a business that employs multiple people. Like, it needs to stay up. It, like, all the critical pieces, and it needs to break less.
You know? I don't think we've ever had a bug
ever
in our React land that's just like, well, I shouldn't say that. There's probably been a few of just like badly coded. I can think of a few actually now, but that was just like just a bug, you know, just like a classic, just like this was coded incorrectly kind of bug, or like a
forgot some logic.
Yeah. Whatever. Much more like networking problems and just, like, the bugs that come in, of which there are still plenty, believe me, are a little bit more abstract than that. You know, they're it's not just just a poor coding shenanigans.
And then, sorry. I'm adding another dimension to it. Like, you have like responsive web design, so it's like when a user at this viewport, you know, slides this slider, I expect it to have a scroll X value of blah.
Yeah, that's that visual testing stuff, which I don't think we do very much of. Which is, isn't there different kinds? There's unit testing, and then there's integration testing.
In visual regression testing. And then functional and unit. Those are other words that float around. So,
indeed.
Think.
Okay, so we did a question. Go us. We should do another one.
Hey, let's do another one.
Sure. JG writes in. Jay's from Birmingham in the United Kingdom. Love the show. Been listening 2 years. I don't think I've heard a question about requirements elicitation. Elicitation? Requirements elicitation. So I wondered how you guys deal with this. I work at an agency, and I find when it comes to developing web apps or mobile apps, they can get quite complex, and sometimes the greatest challenge is getting the plan and the client vision for the system together, including client inputs. Do you guys use flowcharts or use case diagrams with clients to get a system structure? How do you document requirements? How do you, you know, get client approval on requirements before starting development? That's more you than me for sure.
I can go. I think what we do typically is a discovery phase, which I think that was kind of popularized by you know, Adaptive Path, or I guess that's maybe a classic like design agency, marketing agency thing. But in terms of like doing it for the web, HappyCog and Adaptive Path did a lot of it. But it's basically like sitting down and saying, okay, what does this actually need? You know, like don't just come up to us and say you need a website for, you know, for teens. Like let's talk about what, you know, okay, you have an idea. What would this idea manifest as? Because sometimes the client doesn't know what they're asking for, and that sounds terrible, but it's sort of this idea of like, tell us your problems and we'll kind of try to find the best solution. We had a client come to us. They had an old WordPress site, and they're just like, we need updates. We need a new site, a new WordPress site, or maybe Squarespace, you know, just because we want to update text on the website. But right now we have to go file a PO to go get, you know, to have this one company that built the thing in this kind of custom Genesis framework thing to like fix it. It was just like, oh boy, well, let's take a minute, you know, like some hour, let's bucket some hours and we'll try to figure out a plan for you and evaluate some CMSs. Cause I don't think Squarespace is exactly what you want, but maybe there's an alternative. And we came up with something and we ended up using Webflow. Are you familiar with that? It's kind of like a WYSIWYG, editor for websites, and then it builds a little static site and pushes it out in a really super fast Nginx or Node server thing. It's great, and the client is very happy. You know, it's maybe not the best website in the world because it's like all done through a WYSIWYG, you know, which can be good and bad. But they are very happy because they can, for the most part, they can update everything. They can kind of like click on things and see what's going on and see how to change things. And I think that's kind of that was the problem we are trying to solve, you know, is making it easier for them to update the website. And I think it worked. So I think that's part of it, is kind of doing a discovery phase for your clients, and then kind of coming together and getting a list of requirements. Ultimately, they have to sign off on something like you're doing this, or, you know, kind of the proposal. Another trick we've done is kind of less the like selling a project and selling time. Like we kind of sell big buckets of time. Like let's work together for a month, 2 months, 3 months, and try to figure this out together. You know, like because I don't think like we're just going to come up with some bullet points and spit this thing out. So that's kind of another approach. You know, find it, kind of put a price on how much a month of your time is worth, or your agency or a group of people from your agency's time is, and try to sell that. So yeah, we're pretty like, we are less formal. That said, you know, if you're doing big websites like government and city websites, and you know, they probably do want these flowcharts and system structures and stuff to like to go talk about. So but we tend to try to kind of be more embedded and work through things together. So
I like that. Yeah, I mean, when I read this, it just seems like you have to, you need, you can't, what did you, are you going to just start working with no plan at all? Or I mean, that seems weird. Of course you got to lock some stuff in. There's probably people signing stuff even. I don't know.
Yeah. What is Brad Frost has this neat front end framework, or like front end developer framework or something. Questionnaire. Front end guidelines questions. Ooh, that's a mouthful. Let's see. Front end guidelines questionnaire. I'll put a link in the show notes, but you talked about like tools and stuff, like what tools and do's and don'ts and all that. Brad has a pretty good thing for like, let's fill this out together and kind of come up with like just how styles and tooling and version control and everything kind of all works together, just so it's all documented in one place. I tried this with a client and didn't really go so well. Like, it was kind of like, oh, I don't know, or we kind of do different things, like kind of vaguer answers. It wasn't like hardcore concrete. So your mileage may vary, but you know, I think that's a good thing. I think, like, you know, a well-defined scope is good, so you know when you're going out of scope, so you can say you're going out of scope. I think that's really important. But we've had projects where, you know, they wanted like a CMS replatforming, and it's just like, it was impossible to scope before the project. You know, we were putting too many hours in, and we were just like, let's make a bid and we'll figure it out. So that's another thing too, is you just kind of might just have to figure it out, you know, on the fly.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
There's a couple here that I like. Maybe we'll have time to do them both. Let's see. And one is by David Luer here, who writes in. This is kind of an interesting one too, I think. That he's considering using a headless CMS for some time now, but can't figure out how to handle long text slash rich content fields, such as post content, in a way that allows me to place other fields, such as images or block quotes, in between sections in a sustainable and flexible way. I don't want to create several rich content fields for every section or paragraph, nor do I want to force editors to manually code the markup into the content field, but I can't wrap my head around how else to approach this. So I don't know if the headless part matters. This is kind of a problem for CMSs in general forever. I think this is fascinating, right? Like, if your blog posts are always just like five paragraphs and maybe an image chucked in there somewhere, and it's just a tube of content in that, that's just easy. That's just normal. But not everything is like, that's not the, like, what if you need more flexibility than that? Let's say you have three paragraphs, then you have a slider, then you have two more paragraphs, then you have a pull quote, then you have five more paragraphs, and then you have like a set of three boxes next to each other horizontally. It's like, that's tough to do in one field, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's thinking, like, how do I structure that CMS such that ultimately it is one field? I can, like, query one, you know, there's like one URL endpoint, because he's making a headless CMS that returns all of that stuff as one big chunk of content, because it's like, can I build my CMS so that it, like, how do you even approach that at a CMS level? And I think that's interesting. I don't think that's a totally solved problem. You know, I've seen drag and drop content builders that's like, drag this in, then drag this in, then drag this in kind of thing, almost like an email builder kind of thing. But then the end result is like, what is the end result? It's like a really highly customized CMS that, in ultimate, it's probably just HTML sitting in a text field somewhere anyway. Like, I just don't know. I think, you know, just because I live in WordPress land so often, I think they kind of have a fairly nice way of handling it in the form of those square bracket things. What do you call those in WordPress?
The short code?
Short codes, in a way that you...
Shodies, we call them shodies.
But if you need an abstracted concept, you can build a short code. And then in the content area, it's pretty simple. It's just a square bracket, and you can put stuff inside it or attributes or whatever to control it. And it turns into the thing that you need it to turn into. So you're maintaining this like kind of healthy level of abstraction between that thing that gets inserted and the rest of the content.
I think, what's the example? Like inserting an image or a block quote in between sections.
Of course, you can just chuck an image in there. That's not that weird. Or, and of course, you can just put a block tag. That's not that weird. But I'm thinking of something even more weird, like setting three boxes next to each other. What do you put a div in there? Do you hand write a div and then hand write a class on that div and hand write the three divs inside of that div? And it seems like that to me is like CMS code smell or whatever.
Yeah, so you kind of want to build a structure where you kind of have some short code, like graph rows 1, 2, 3 or something, or whatever, and that transpiles into some kind of HTML on the fly.
Or I think so.
In the template. Yeah, I think that's probably good. I think I'm always just a fan of clean markup, whatever gets you to the cleanest, you know. That's why I use a markdown, yeah. Just because it's like, it's clean. I want my input fields to be clean.
I like that too, but your blogging requirements aren't that crazy. You know, it's not, you don't need to support like 50 different article types that are all are like, I need a slideshow down here. I need a call to action over here. I need a, you know,
right.
Like a really super flexible CMS that also is just doesn't make any codes. I don't know. It's just, I think it's not unsolvable, but the solution is very specific to your company and it's.
Yeah. I think you almost have to like take a step back and kind of back to the discovery phase is take a look at all your content. See what you have, see what's bad, like what's munged in and, you know, come up with, you know, like the three archetypal post types and then the 10 and then like 100 kind of that you're testing against or whatever. And, you know, what do you have like, oh, we have these weird interactive charts at the top of each of these pages or like 10 different pages. So that's like a scenario our CMS would have to support. I think once you kind of understand your content and understand that, then you can kind of start making optimizations in the database. I think anyone would say, understand it before you like start manipulating code or else you're just going to have like more problems later. Like you're either going to split up your content too much. And then you can also like, here's what, let's support, like, let's come up with the CMS structure that we have. And then, you know, if we add stuff, or even like, what would we like to be? That's like another sort of question you can ask when you're kind of doing a database. We just did this with Shop Talk Show. We looked at 4 years of content and we said, okay, we do this a lot. We have a list of links with, you know, time jump links. We have a list of, you know, links, we have a guest or, you know, and the guests have URLs and Twitter accounts. And, you know, we kind of came up with our data model, based on a backlog of posts, you know? You can do that. You just have to kind of look at your content and look at what's going on. And then write the code to kind of suit your content strategy, going forward.
Fantastic.
Did that sum it up? It okay. Yeah. All right. We got one more. You want to do one more here?
Hey. You already queued up the audio, right?
Audio question. Here we go. It's from, I'm clicking the wrong buttons. This is from Josh Smith. Here we go.
I recently heard you guys talk about the virtues of CSS frameworks. One con that you mentioned was a huge amount of unused CSS that gets bundled with each website. Well, that isn't necessarily the case all the time, at least with frameworks like Foundation. Foundation specifically built with SAS and heavily leverages imports for each feature. Basically, if you don't need the feature, it's up to the developer not to include it. I think these frameworks get a bad rap, usually from the uninitiated. Once someone told me that they don't use somebody else's code, and then went right back to using WordPress. But in summary, modern frameworks are super powerful and are not for the beginner. They use SAS to limit the size of the end product, but also incorporate even more enhancements like Gulp and Grunt, which can further reduce size of CSS, amongst other things. But I'd just like to hear what you guys think about modern frameworks and how they can fit into a development workflow.
So, I feel... just some self-defense. I feel like we're very clear, like most are written in SAS and you can comment out the things to like some partials. But I think we all know most people don't. I mean, what, maybe I'm way too harsh but the average size of websites is like 3 megabytes right now, Chris. So what, you know, obviously,
not that it requires a retort, but somebody dug up some data that said that it was a little bit more nuanced than that. That was like the biggest offenders are getting to be worse offenders, and they're skewing that number towards that 3 megabyte number. But on average, like some of the biggest sites are actually starting to come down a little bit. And I was like, oh, that's encouraging.
Well, that's good.
Pretty cool. Like it's like the evangelism is working a little bit. But I mean, the worst offenders getting worse isn't good news or anything. But it's not everybody that's offending that much. There's some stuff that I liked in here, though. Like, certainly if you just, like, use the way that you use Bootstrap is to just take, a distribution copy of it that has everything, the kitchen sink under it, and just load it up and use it. That's the bad rap, right? That's the, like, I'm shipping a bunch of CSS that I'm not using. This is weird and crazy. But Josh absolutely has a point. That's not how you have to use these frameworks. Like, certainly not Foundation or Bootstrap or many others. You can use the development copy of them, and they highly encourage that. And they have it set up to change SAS variables and, you know, customize what you use and don't use to do that. And I think a lot of people know that. That's not a big surprise here, and that's how you can reduce your size and customize what you're doing and all that. What I particularly liked about this is that sentiment. Like, I don't know, but the worry says modern frameworks are super powerful and not for the beginner. Like, I don't think beginners need to be afraid of them, but there's a sentiment that I don't use frameworks because I'm not a beginner anymore. Like, these things are for beginners, and I'm an amazing developer. I don't need a framework to help me. That there's another way to look at that. And there's like, no, these frameworks are actually quite robust and quite complicated and quite, you can do lots of very advanced things with them, and you can be a very advanced developer and still use them. I just think there's some truth to that I like.
Yeah. I think it's this false dichotomy, you know, this like, oh, I'm good at CSS, so I don't need them. It's like, I don't know what, like, you know, why he points out, why would you just use WordPress? Like, you know,
I mean, be a great CSS developer and use a framework with one client and not a framework with another client. And as a matter of fact, that probably makes you even better because you're that adaptable.
Yeah. And you kind of understand, you can take learnings from like this framework that's solving a lot of problems. You know, that, I think that's the thing with frameworks is they solve a lot of problems and they take an opinionated point of view on how they're going to solve this, you know, number of problems. And you might not have those problems, you know, so you probably want to code your own or you don't like their solution. So you want to code your own. I think that's great. But I'm a fan of frameworks and just getting the job done, but I also see the value in you know, paring it down. I go back to the accessibility project, which I help wrangle, but less so. More talented people are doing it now. But, you know, we did a redesign and we got rid of 238 kilobytes of CSS down to like 6, you know, just by ditching Bootstrap. And we are all talented developers. It's an open source project, but no one went through and pruned out the SAS partials. You know, we're using like Bootstrap SAS or something. So that's just to say, even talented people do it bad. So I'm kind of just saying, you can, I don't know where I'm going. I'm just adding more data points to anecdotes to this conversation. So,
Sounds good, man. We did good.
Lots of words on this podcast. Well, if you like words, be sure to subscribe in your podcast of choice and do us a favor and star heart. Fave that up because that's how people find out about the show. Thank you, dear listener. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one. And I hope you enjoyed this this episode of Hashtag Share Your Drafts. Chop Talk Show. Chris, yeah, anything else you'd like to say?
ChopTalkShow.com.